My voice is carrying?
Oh, good.
The world stood on the edge of an abyss. Do you know about the abyss? The bounce is welcome, but do we believe that this bounce can come with us without consequence? For there must be consequence, and so there will be consequence. But with consequence comes opportunity. Today's presentation will talk about the consequences of the global financial crisis, the evolution of our social and financial markets over the coming years, and some of the opportunities that that presents. Our presenter today is Robert Hooke. Some of you know Robert. Robert is a 30-year-plus veteran of managing Australian equities, 20 years from the Far East managing Australian equities, so he brings an external perspective of Australia and the global dynamic. He's also been portfolio manager of Australian equities at National Asset Management, also head of Australian equities at HSBC, and then most recently, since 2004, has joined SG Hiscox, where he's portfolio manager of SGH 20-year concentrated Australian equities fund. So today's presentation, without further ado, I'll be handing over to Robert. He'll be introducing that there are going to be consequences from the global financial crisis, and very real and dire consequences, but that a concentrated portfolio of Australian equities can withstand some of the portfolio can withstand some of those headwinds, but also looking for some of those opportunities. We were talking about this last night, and we had the Seinfeld example of one hand up, one hand down, and even Stephen. We thought about the cup. Is the cup half empty or half full? Perhaps another way to look at it is some cups will be empty and some cups will be full. Thank you, Robert.
Right. Thanks, Boyd. That was not meant to be the introduction, but I guess it woke me up as no one else. Thank you very much for this opportunity of being able to speak to you. I think it is in a very important junction where we are at present in the markets. And what I'd like to do is explore a little bit further what I've called future shock, which is taken from Alvin Toffler, who wrote a book some time back, 1970 thereabouts, in a different context, of course, but today I think it is equally apt, because what we have seen in the past 18 months or so, I believe, is going to have ramifications throughout the industry and throughout the financial world for a long period to come. And really will, like a river course, will change the future of history in many ways. So I know those are bold statements, but really of the 30 or 35 years I've been in markets, this has been quite a significant move in financial markets, and I would say it's the equivalent to the financial tsunami that we've seen, the huge volatilities that never existed before in markets. In times when markets had specialists and jobbers where open cry system allowed much more sedate dealing, we have a situation where, as what part of Alvin Toffler was saying, that this huge explosion of information that hits us so rapidly means that any event today, wherever it happens in the world, is translated immediately into the financial sector. And so what we have on a screen-based trading system, we have thousands of investors either trying to buy or sell the same stock, and very often it's a bit like pushing bubblegum through the keyhole. And it does have enormous consequences in the markets and creates great volatility. So what I'd like to do is really just explore a little bit of where I saw things developing, really, to provide the basis for the moves in the markets and this huge swelling of money that is really supplied for what some people would say the speculative binge that ended up in the last year or so. Alternatively, you can look and see the good, the massive amount of money swishing around the world, the printing of the dollars, and huge reserves in various countries. So before we look at the Greenspan era, and I think this is a real great watershed, we had normal responses to economic laws and rules and regulations applied within the economic framework. In other words, if you went out and you was a country ran a trade deficit for very long, the impact would eventually hit your currency. But we've had the United States of America and other countries who've been able to use flows of capital and also benefit the world in many ways by running these huge deficits, but at the same time causing other problems. Those deficits are then used to fund back into economies, and also regrettably in many respects fund speculation. So what we saw after Greenspan came along was the crash of 87. We saw the long-term capital management, we saw the tech wreck, we saw 9/11. All these events occurred under his watch, as it were. And we saw gradually, and not so gradually at times, the creation of huge leverage just through financial and exotic implements. Long-term capital management, of course, nearly destroyed everything, but the world was brought back from the brink. And in fairness, some of the things Greenspan did help to solve a lot of the problems, but they were very short-term. But each and every one of them meant cutting interest rates, flooding the capital markets with money, and stabilizing the system. And what I would say is that instead of allowing the system to correct itself, we sort of papered over the cracks. And as a consequence of this, ultimately, we have to pay the tune that we've really ignored in the past. And part of that has now come to rest in what we've seen and called part of the global financial crisis. Now, accumulation of these reserves has been enormous. And as I mentioned, it's actually been quite good from a point of view of trade flows, developing countries, and so on. But that's providing everyone plays by the book. But not all countries believe that they should allow their currencies to float. So what we've had is an enormous move in favor of countries like China and so on, where money has flowed in because of the benefits of trade due to a lower renminbi than it should be. And you have a very much a free market enterprise system prevailing in the United States and mercantilist philosophies in China, where it is seen that the bigger the reserves you have, the better it is, and the more that you're actually considered in terms of power and so on and so forth. As we can see, there's been enormous amounts of money, and it's not only just China and Japan, but it's the Caribbean countries, the offshore centers, the oil exporters, and others, as you see, accounts for almost 40% of that whole total, and that's the rest of the world, the Indias and South Africas and Brazils and Mexicos and Canadas and so on. Now, these monies were not only moved into treasuries, they were also used to fund such as things as the carry trade. And on Australia, just as an aside, we've also benefited because the banks have lent net-net or borrowed something like $600 billion from overseas sources. And now you see the problem is the banks have to keep on carrying that borrowing forward because that amount of resources is not within the country. We've seen the government response to the global financial crisis, and this is what I call the blame game, where hedge funds, Wall Street bankers, offshore tax havens, deregulation, greed and short selling is all their fault. It has nothing at all to do with how the government's regulated the systems in their eyes. So what we're saying, we've all enjoyed a great party, but unfortunately now the hangover. The problem is, are the economies lying down and resting and just going through the motions of suffering the pain, or are we just going to have another drink and kick on? And it looks like that is what we're going to do. So G20 moved, and the first thing they said, well, we've got to have more regulation. That they agreed on immediately. So I entitled this the sacrifice of liberty. Second thing the Americans did primarily was to stabilize the banking system, which I think was very important, very necessary. And then, of course, we had global fiscal stimuli or stimuluses, the borrowing or printing of money, and what I call the sacrifice of discipline. So the economic forces were not allowed to really play out. We live in a very different society today where unemployment is no longer acceptable in terms of the politicians, and the hard lessons are not going to be learnt. We're going to take the soft option all along the line, I'm afraid. So if you'll allow me to indulge in just what I see in one slide, and this is obviously many books of thousands of pages written on difference between capitalism and neoliberalism, or whatever you like to call it. But as I've seen it, Adam Smith believed in maximization of profits. And as we moved through the period of time, we moved to a much kinder type of economic system where we call it free enterprise or neo-capitalism or neo-liberalism, whatever you like, But we don't any longer have little kids digging down in coal mines to pull coal up for very rich families. We've moved away from that, hopefully, although there are unfortunately some parts of the world that do. But what it has meant is that the optimization of profits have become much more the goal. But what we've also seen as part of this is this kind of society, more and more government regulation, to the point where it starts off meaning well, but in the end becomes just an enormous, overwhelming machine. And unfortunately, I believe morality has been overtaken by legality. So in other words, where I was brought up in the stock market, it was dictum meum pactum, my word is my bond. I don't know many people even talk about that nowadays, to be honest. And very often we are forced into situations where moral decisions are not necessarily legal either. And we've only got to look at every time you load down new software, or if you buy a Qantas flight, you have all sorts of rules and regulations which at the end of you tick a little box and say, yes, I've read all this and I agree. But I've never read one of those Microsoft things down to the last letter. I tried once. It didn't mean much to me by the end of it. But the reality is that we're going to see more and more of this regulation coming through. And it will take from us much of the freedom that we've had in the past. So this other little slide I picked up in a coffee shop. So I don't know who wrote it, but it's a very wise word. And one I could interpret it saying is, a wise man also does not borrow more than he can repay, unless he, of course, has no intention of repaying it. So just to recap, and some of you would have seen these numbers before, but I think it's important to really get some sort of idea, what is the difference between a million and a billion and a trillion? And that is the difference. A million seconds, 11 and a half days. A billion seconds is 31... Oh, it's going slowly. Even slower. 31.7 years. And then a trillion is 31,000 years. So when governments are borrowing this sort of money, to try and get our minds around it, it's huge sums. It's a multiple of what they borrowed in the past. And it's quite staggering, really, when we think of those numbers. I mean, when we did my algebra and arithmetic at school, no one even had a trillion in the vocabulary. So we've moved from fiscal prudence, which was dictated by economic laws, to more of a fiscal black hole where we've got massive global stimulation. 700 billion in TARP, some of which has now been repaid. Surprise, surprise, when you tell senior bankers that they can't get big bonuses, they find the money and they pay it back. 860 billion fiscal stimulus, take a few billion off that or add a few, but only 20% of that is still being spent. In the UK, the deficit is going to be £1.3 trillion by the year 2011-12. Japan and China spend £700 billion in their fiscal stimulation. And Australia, depending on whose numbers you look at, anywhere between £200 and £300 billion. Now, if you just think about this, Britain spent £94 billion last year on the national health. At a 5% interest rate, they'll be paying £65 billion. Just in interest alone. And you've got to ask yourself, where are these governments going to get the money from? The consequences of all these stimulants were market recovers, great. I believe we have a V-shaped recovery. LIBOR moved to normal, that was another tick, but unfortunately budgets blew out. And I have what I call the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is interest rates came down, and that's the traditional cure for these issues. But the bad, however, what I've alluded to is budgets, and I've just used the budget of the United States because that's the most important one. And last night you would have probably read that actually moved from 6 to 7 billion, up to 9 billion is the latest estimate. And that's without the national health that they plan to bring in. So if you believe Obama's going to get the health system, there's $10 billion deficit by the year 2012-13. That is an enormous amount of money. It is $500 billion every year in interest of 5%. And the United States has never, ever run a surplus of $500 billion. So the question is, where is all the money going to come from? The real ugly thing is the federal balance sheet, which is now well over $2 billion. This is because of what we now call quantitative easing, but previously it just happened to be called printing of money. But that sounded pretty bad, because that's what the Weimar Republic done, and that's what our friend in Zimbabwe has been doing. So it's much better to call it quantitative easing. It sounds very professional, doesn't it? So, the taxing time. Traditionally, governments would cut expenditure. But today, governments are too big to fail. In other words, governments employ so many people, have a finger in so many pies, that they just cannot go out and cut massive projects. They have to maintain the employment workforce, because it will be self-defeating if you go and put 300,000 people out of work just because you're going to cut down on various schemes and issues. So one of the problems is that government is faced with this situation. We can't cut our expenditure. What are we going to do? Well, clearly they're going to tax us until the pips squeak, as has been heard to remark in the House of Lords once. And really, the companies, the mines, everyone, I believe, in this country, and more so overseas, is going to bear a greater burden of taxation. We're already seeing the UK has raised the higher tax rate. We're getting all sorts of kites being flown by the Henry Commission. I think last week they were talking about taxation on private homes. A couple of days ago it was reformulating the tax on the mines. And all it means is the governments want to bring taxation under one umbrella, so it's much easier in a budget to go there and say, right, instead of 5% overall tax, we're going to raise it to 6% or whatever. And don't forget that we're not even talking about the massive deficits the states within the United States and our own federal states here are running up. If you add all this up, I don't know what the numbers are, but they just really accelerate the problem. So the other source is to borrow money from the savers, and this traditionally has been the issue. And the Treasury bills will go out there, and they'll put out the tenders, and they will get in money, and a lot of the money comes from, as you saw early on, and read about in the papers, from China and India and all those countries that have excess and surplus dollars. They don't only lend it to the Fed, but they lend it out all over the place. And when the Fed interest rates get too low, they will seek other areas where they can get higher interest rates, and that, to a large degree, is what helped formulate and create the crisis that we're seeing. The carry trade became an enormous issue and had to be unwound eventually, and probably still is in the process of it. The third way of doing that is to print money. Now, the problem with borrowing money from the savers is if you're going to keep on borrowing more, that pool of money starts pushing out the genuine borrowers who want to invest the money in industry. Somewhere along the line, people are going to be prepared to pay higher interest rates. So the government then has to also start moving its interest rates, because that pool of money available for borrowing becomes less. So that then also becomes counterproductive, because what happens is interest rates go up. If interest rates go up, that becomes a drag on the economy. So we see that governments are going to get into this bind over the next couple of years. And the question is, to what degree are they going to continue to print money? My argument is that we're going to see a limit on taxation. There is a limit to what you can tax people of, and particularly if economies don't continue to grow. We're going to see governments unable to service their debts, because by borrowing through traditional means and taxing individuals, they're not going to get enough money in. And here I'm talking really in the major economies, such as those in Europe, the UK and the US. We're a little bit more fortunate, but we are going in that direction. And we're going to see demand by government for debt that just continues to soar. So money is going to be printed. I'm quite convinced of that. Quantitative easing is going to be the name of the game, because really we do not have the wherewithal to produce things. Now, this obviously has consequences. Part of that is going to be the over-regulation and more government control, and we're starting to see it particularly in the financial industry. Isn't it amazing how governments really just believe they always know better and they will continuously push the belt? And it's all done in order to protect individuals, and that's good, and certainly we need that. But if I go back and read, when you look at the crashes that occurred in the 1830s and the 1860s, the 1929s, the 70s, the 90s, Milken and all that, what do we see? Reality. There's always some nasty people who are going to get out there and work their way around the system. And we've seen lately just huge scams and frauds. And whatever the government does, someone will find a way, because they just unfortunately happen to be dishonest people. And we're all paying the price, and it is very costly. I know when I was working in London, when I started there in 91, the compliance department consisted of HR and a secretary. 3 or 4 years later, when I left, the compliance department was an entire floor, one full-time lawyer, and about 18 people working for it. The costs are just enormous. And it is unfortunate. Some of it's necessary, but some of it is just the result of government agencies seeking more and more power. The other problem is, I think, and this is one that's going to really face us all, particularly financial planners and me as a fund manager, is superannuation and pensions are going to be seen as a honeypot. And I think we have to be aware that over-regulation and any pools of money can be seen as something that governments will really want to get their sticky little fingers into. And it's not so long ago that I remember, particularly in the UK and US, where governments insisted that pension funds, the big company-funded pension funds in those days, would have to invest certain percentages in government bonds. And the whole issue is, could that come back again, where we are forced, which has been mooted, in the lines of, well, we need infrastructure projects, so therefore maybe the pension funds could perhaps fund this. And they'll be funded either in the way of loans or convertibles or something like that. But clearly these are areas that we have to be aware of, and we're going to have to fight for our rights as well, because no one really wants to be stuck in a whole lot of bonds that are actually going to cause your real value loss because of inflation. And I haven't really touched on that horrible word, inflation, because I think if we look at the real inflation numbers the government's put out today, they have been dumbed down since the Volckers of this era, the American ones in particular. So what we see, inflation numbers, are not really what is affecting our pockets in our lifetime. And there is a certain reality about all this, because governments employ more people, and as they employ more people, and as most individuals' salaries in governments are tied to the CPI, governments don't want CPIs to look ugly or bad, and politically it's not acceptable anyway. And then, of course, the reserve banks have to increase interest rates. So we have to look behind the numbers, and you must forgive my skepticism, but having been around in some of the shops and just comparing prices over the last couple of years, you can see yourself how anything and everything seems to have gone up. So the conclusion is, I believe that next few years, the role of governments are going to become more intrusive. We're going to see volatility of equity markets increase, and economies burdened by debt will be lower to recover. Now, I think that is going to be the rather difficult situation, because we believe in this V-shaped recovery. But the question is, will the consumer come back, particularly in the United States? And I think it's going to be a long, hard struggle. Sentiment has improved. We've seen money go for the clash for clunkers, but what happens when you start distorting the economy and people buy a new motor car? A lot of people won't go out and buy that new sofa or television set. It's as simple as that. So governments, unfortunately, have started to distort parts of the economy, and we saw that after here when the bank guarantee came in and all those mortgage funds had to be frozen. So there are going to be problems, but ultimately, if governments want to pay down their debt, they're going to have to inflate it away. So that is going to be the real question. And that leads me to where I believe there is a need to look at an alternative approach. As I mentioned before, we've had volatility in markets, which are really skewed developments of markets altogether. And we can no longer I believe that real wealth is created over the long term. If you buy good stocks, you will come out correctly, but my goodness, you need nerves of steel sometimes, because I've seen stocks take 5 years to double and 5 months to halve. And they're good stocks. It's just people's perceptions. And how do you live through that? We have to look at the yield and the sustainability of companies in this new environment. I think we have to be very much stock pickers. We have to be index unaware. We can't just buy the market, because the market's going to be subject to this huge mass of money moving in and moving out on a continuous basis, where stocks are being bought purely and simply because they're in the index, not because of what they are producing. And I don't think we're going to go back to the flat markets that we saw in the United States in the 70s and 80s, where it took nearly 10 years for markets to actually move ahead. But I do think that it's going to be folly to chase pure index-related stocks, because we'll want to see quality. Whatever we buy will have to be quality. We'll have to be able to ride the regulation. We'll have to deliver profit after company taxes are raised. Well, not the company taxes, but taxes all across the system. And I'm thinking more of the mines 3 or 4 years out, when the possibility that the mines are seen as this rich honeypot. And don't believe it's not impossible, because the British government, going back 2 years ago, imposed a super tax on oil companies. So when they see the profits are there, and when they're short of cash, all these issues will develop. So we also believe that one should be looking at accumulating hard assets more in the form of shares, because that's what I'm talking about here. But clearly there are other issues where you can buy ETFs and so on, and buy physical gold or whatever you want to do. But here we're talking about, we want companies that have hard assets as backing. We do like the commodities purely and simply because they're something real and tangible. We do like gold, and we do like property on the long term, because that has always been a hedge against inflation. So I think looking forward, we're going to have a very different view on how we view the markets if we're going to make money. And, you know, this is exciting as well as being difficult times, but it does offer great opportunities if we get our mindset correct. And I'm not saying that everything that I said is going to happen on a given date or at a given time or at all, but what I do believe is we've got to start thinking about these issues so that when we see the signposts, we can say, yes, we know what is going to come next. Yes, if governments keep on printing money, we know inflation is going to follow. So these are tried and true issues that have happened throughout history, and governments simply cannot go on spending the money that they are spending without having to print it or recourse to higher taxes. And I'm afraid we are going to look at the higher printing of money. So I hope that's given some food for thought. I'd be happy to answer some questions. But thank you very much for your time.
Well, here we go. I am on. Robert, thank you for taking us through the consequences. And now we've started to move towards the opportunities. If you could just press the next slide. What my role here as the business development manager is to take you through the product. What I'd like to do is dispense with the sales pitch, but put to you a couple of questions particularly. With the previous slide, we talked about being index unaware. One of the questions I'd like to... You've created a portfolio that has 15 to 25, no less than 15, no more than 25. Why did you prefer something like that instead of 80 or 60 stocks?
Well, I think the real issue is, isn't it better to have 25 of the best stocks in your portfolio than 80? Because by the time you get down to 30 or 40, you're not really putting good stocks in. And I think this was coloured by the time when I worked in London. The index buyers, Polytech was in the top 100. Polytech was run by someone who wasn't exactly straight, and it went bankrupt. But unfortunately, a lot of people actually ended up by buying Polytech because it was in the index. And I just believe that you buy quality companies, and quite frankly, between 20 and 25 will give you a very, very good and suitable portfolio.
With the third point, we're not particularly going to write up there and distribute that we're running an unsound, illogical investment philosophy, but perhaps you could explore on what your philosophy is.
Well, basically, I do believe that that real wealth is created over the long term, and if you look at some of the great companies in the past that have grown, whether it be the Microsofts or the Woolworths and so on, these are the companies that you really have to focus on. The issue today, as I alluded to, is the volatility in these companies and in stock markets, and we have to work our mind around it. But you will only survive by having quality companies and taking a long-term view. In other words, don't just jump out because the price happens to drop. Jump out if the company does something wrong, but not just because the price drops.
Just on the fourth point, is there a problem with asset allocation, or is there a reason you prefer one over the other?
We don't work on asset allocation. I have worked on it in the past. It is an extremely difficult thing to do correctly, accurately, and consistently. And very often you end up by chasing a market that has already moved. I sat on a number of asset allocations, both globally and here, and I always felt we were behind the curve, really, because we were not preempting as we should have been. So in terms of asset allocation, if anything, what drives our portfolio, and I don't really like using the word thematics, because when I used to deal in the Japanese market, there was a new thematic every day. But the reality was that we've tried to seek out areas in terms of what we believe happening in the future, the higher taxes and some of the things that I've spoken about, and seen areas that really there is going to be growth. And one of the areas we focused on, and it's really come to the fore in the last couple of days, in fact, is the developments in the oil and gas fields in Western Australia and Eastern Australia, Papua New Guinea. Now, that hasn't come about just overnight. We spent the last 18 months traveling to the area, trying to find the right companies. And we really believe that the Gorgon progress thing would go ahead, and it was announced and confirmed today that it is now going ahead. But this means that we can focus on areas where we know, regardless of what happens in the economy, there is going to be massive expenditure, $50 billion up to $200 billion in the next 12, 15 years in that area. And there are going to be a number of companies that are going to make money out of that. And hence, we have that's just one area we would focus on. It's not really asset allocation. It's sort of, I suppose, thematics. But it's also part of just finding good companies, because in that area, not all companies will do well.
Two more questions before we hand to the audience. After tax, if I look at the tables for all Australian equities funds, you're probably number one over 3 and 5 years. How does after tax fit into your portfolio?
We believe in after tax. I ran the imputation fund at HSBC, and I just think it's really important that the money in your pocket is what you make. I'm also a shareholder in the fund, so I know about that. And the reality is that in this country, with imputation credits, with effect, the fact that you, if you hold a stock for a year or more, you have a discounted tax rate, it becomes very tax effective and enhances the real return that you get out of your pocket. So sometimes the numbers of performances are not always as good as after-tax returns. And I think, and I do see the industry is trying to move towards this after-tax concept, but it appears to be a little more difficult for some people, but it is an important one.
With the last slide, we've heard a lot about the qualitative. I enjoy that kind of discussion. But is quantitative a heart and soul of your fund, or is it still an important part?
No, it's important, because really you have to look at valuations, DCFs, MPVs, whatever you want to call it, cash flows. Most importantly, we like to look at operating cash flows. We don't believe that companies that create profits out of fiat, book them, pay them in dividends and borrow the money to do so, is significant. But the important thing is I think statistics and what we know about the financials of companies and all that has been so worked over, it's really become a commodity. We like to take that further and try and say, how do you really, what do you make of that company? How do you understand management? Where's management taking it? So management's very important. What does that company do? Is it a good company? Is it a bad company? Good products and all that sort of thing. And really then try and say, right, that's how I can add value. It's no point. There's thousands of fund managers out there pushing the same numbers to the same screens and more or less getting the same answers. We want to come out with some different answers.
All right. Thank you. The next three slides, if you could just rotate through those, Robert, while I just mentioned. We have these bits and pieces. Before I hand over for questions and answers, Robert will be with us hopefully after lunch, but also through lunch and through the networking and the drinks this evening. He travels Australia regularly. He visits offices. Please let us know that. We also have, for each of you before you leave, one of these memory sticks, my apologies, with this presentation and a little bit more of the qualitative, quant analysis as well. Naturally, the fund is rated. what are we saying? Cyclically positive, structurally negative?
Yeah.
Is that a good way to...
Yeah.
Cyclically positive, structurally negative. Yeah. Look, I'll hand over for some more questions. Thanks very much, Robert.
Thanks, guys. Okay, we've got Angela Ashton now, who's going to give us her take on what we've just seen. Thanks, Angela.
Thanks. I guess we didn't spend a lot of time on the fund, but certainly all of your discussion was very interesting. In terms of wrapping up regarding the fund, though, I guess we can say that if you're looking at this fund perhaps to use in a portfolio, it's obviously going to have a lot of stock-specific risk. The largest holding is Worley Parsons, for example, so it's not a, even within the 15 to 25 stocks that it does hold, it doesn't hold anything like the index, so that it's going to have a lot of stock-specific risk. And that's obviously how it's going to generate alpha, hopefully.
Yes. I'm with you there.
Okay. It's probably going to have a very variable beta as well as a result, which means that probably at times it's going to be lower risk than the market generally, and at other times it's going to be higher risk. So it's going to, within a portfolio, tend to be, I guess, a bit of a swinging fund in terms of you will not be able to say, this is going to be my core low-risk, long-term holding, and you're not going to be able to say all the time that is my that it's my very high-risk holding. It's going to be variable at times. Its tracking error, however, is probably going to be high, given that its smaller companies, you know, feature high in those sort of, you know, top five holdings, for example. I would have thought it would be suitable to look at for those of you who use a core satellite approach to portfolio construction as a satellite, or perhaps as, you know, sort of, you know, that type of structure, a satellite fund even within, you know, a more conventional structure or approach. So I would have thought that this is a satellite type fund. So for those of you who are looking for funds that are going to generally run higher tracking errors, tend to be very variable, hold a lot of stock-specific risk, this might be one that you might want to look at. This is the sort of fund that's going to help you deliver that. And to be honest, there's actually not that many funds in the Australian retail market that actually do that. Most of them do tend to have lower tracking errors. You know, we can all name the top five holdings of 90% of Australian equity funds. So this is going to be a little bit different in terms of that. So I also get to ask the first question. So I guess... so this is going to be interesting, I guess. In terms of the scenario that you've painted, it's clearly you believe that inflation is going to increase over the next few years at some point. So I guess on a personal note, should we all borrow to the fullest extent we can right at the moment and buy every hard asset we can? So is this actually another excuse to leverage up higher?
A difficult question, I think, which everyone will probably attack through their own mind, but clearly it is always subject to one's own personal wherewithals. And as I said early on, a wise man doesn't borrow more than he's able to repay, so I'll just leave it at that. But obviously there are opportunities.
From the audience, yep.
Need a couple of preconditions for inflation to increase, of which that is one. Another one might be excess demand relative to supply. And the case that we've got a global an overcapacity in terms of the ability to manufacture certain goods and services. So how might additional factors that impact inflation other than monetary supply actually impact those emerging inflation?
Well, that's one of the reasons.
Hang on. Do you need that question repeated up the back, or did everyone hear it? Okay.
Right, well, and that's absolutely right, and one of the reasons why I alluded to hard assets more than, and my comments about the inflation numbers were, A, they're massaged by governments, and B, we're not going to see the sort of cost push and demand pull type of inflation that we've seen in the past. I know, you know, going back many years now, when my mother wanted to buy a new fridge, you'd go along and you had Frigidaire, 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 and Frigidaire, and you had one colour to choose from, and by the way, you've got to wait 3 months before that arrives. Today you go in and buy a fridge and there's 50 different makes, 25 colours of each, and you can have it right now. And that sort of demand, supply is there. So we're not going to see those competitive issues arise. And obviously there are going to be other issues which start having impacts. The carbon trading is going to impact electricity costs, which will force prices up anyway because everyone's going to make a profit. So the inflationary impacts are going to come from the government intervention and, I believe, from hard assets where people... There's this huge pool of money around and it has to find a home. So where does it find a home? Ultimately, it will be in the hard asset side. And that's why I really try to focus on sort of what I would call the hard assets. But I do agree that between government intervention and the sort of goods in the shops, there will be this kind of benign inflation.
Another question?
I guess you have fairly high tilt in the portfolio for the oil and gas sector or the energy sector. So I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about your views there. And if that's a longer term view,
We do have a high holding in that. And as was mentioned earlier, Worley Parsons is a larger stock. Now, that falls under the energy sector, although it is not entirely energy. So I think there's a bit of distortion in the sort of index composition, but we have to kind of stick to that when we show you those things. Two of our major holdings are on Woodside and Oil Search, both of which are going for massive expansion over the next 10, 15 years. Oil Search we like in particular because I think it's going to be away from excessive government taxing because it's in another country. And Woodside, because as it develops Pluto 2 and 3 and Browse and all these, has a huge upwards trajectory. Secondly, we have invested quite a bit of money in those companies that will benefit by providing engineering services, support, maintenance to the oil and service industries, on the belief that when the Chevron decides, as it will soon probably decide on Gorgon, they're going to commit $50 billion. They base their numbers on a long-term oil price of $40, $45 a barrel, and they will proceed with that project for the next 10, 15 years. And that alone will bring about $50 billion of expenditure. So this is a long-winded answer, I know, but in part it's been driven by the fact that we don't see that sort of growth rate in other sectors of the market, and B, it's been driven by very real and definite growth in the industry. And if you want to add on the longer-term view on an oil price, where I believe we have seen peak oil and the demand for places like China, India, etc., coming up, then I think you have to come up pretty positive, or we're pretty positive on it.
The back there.
Well, I'm the numbers in terms of, if you want to buy a new TV or that sort of thing, I don't think you're going to see those capital goods kind of things going up dramatically. But as I say, sooner or later there will be an impact through electricity prices, wages and so on. So it'll be more demand pull, but it won't be a cost push. I think that's the right term, isn't it? It'll be a cost push rather than demand pull. But also governments will massage their numbers. The American government is now focusing a lot on qualitative benefits. In other words, a motor car now has more frills to it than it did in 1970, and therefore the equivalent cost actually drops, etc., etc. So it depends how you read the inflation numbers.
Yep.
Robert, just your view on taxpayers, whether we're going to see much benefit for a dollar and the level of government stimulus federally?
Well, we certainly have to pay the taxes. Somewhere along the line, someone's going to pay it. So whether you regard that as a benefit or not, and it is very targeted, and this is what we've seen. The reality is, yes, it has helped certain sales, and it's been very good for the property market, but it's brought forward a lot of purchases. In addition to that, you've got to question whether the actual markdown in prices in the shops by anything up to 50% didn't attract buyers anyway who would have been there. We do know a lot of money, and you just have to speak to the Tabcorps and the tattoo parlors and things like that, and they were major beneficiaries. I don't necessarily think that... yes, it's true. I didn't speak to them, but I... I think we're just going to end up by paying, and there's going to be a pocket of people that will continue to benefit. But it's not always going to be the investor, I'm afraid. I don't know, does that answer the question?
Yeah, I suppose more from the point of view, the level that we've had of stimulus as opposed to countries that, like, we need to fall into an abyss.
No.
A lot of
I think personally our stimulus package was overdone because we really can't afford it, and it wasn't necessary, certainly in hindsight. But the reality is the thing that's going to pull us out of the dirt is going to be what happens in the United States and China. You know, we can stimulate as much as we like, but if those two countries don't come right, we're just throwing money in, we're wasting it, we're burning it. So I think there's a lot of political move behind it. If you look at the budget, they could have increased taxes and a whole range of things, from alcohol and cigarettes and things like that. They didn't. So I'm a bit cynical in that respect, and I guess there are politics being played, but that's another game altogether.
Angela, you got a question?
Yep. So is this a bear market rally?
Not really, and I don't want to get away from that. I think what we saw in October was an excessive downward move in the market. So what has happened is those markets have now recovered. I think in October the index was around about 3,800 and it then crashed down to 32 and 30. I think we've seen a recovery to what should have been the norm, because that was just pure panic selling. I think we've seen a recovery. We've certainly seen a V-shaped recovery in some of the economists are calling for that. But I do think that it's going to run into the water running into sands eventually, because I just don't think that the spending by the consumer is going to be there to take the rally much beyond that. In other words, structurally, I think the economy has a lot of problems, but we'll be dealing with those. That's real aftershock when the economy has to, how are we going to pay for this debt? Will the consumer come to the fore? And basically, this is really what economics is about. You know, the United States should pull in its horns. It should become a saving nation. It should get its balance of payments back into kilter. But if it's not going to do that, well, things, we're not going to right the problems. But it would be a very painful process. So hopefully it'll be managed properly. But I think it's all political. So the Americans seem to have an ability to complicate issues that are not always complicated. But does that answer the question?
If you'd like to join me in thanking Equity Trustees Robert and Peter.